is with my sister, said Malia Grant. But Guinevere said, high and shrill, I am no sister of his. This man claims to be my father's son because his mother was, for a time, one of the king's women. He is no son of my father's, but a base-born clown who belongs in a farmyard, though my father has been kind enough to give him a place in his household. You'd best get out of our way, said Lancelot, surveying Meleagrant with contempt. And it was easy enough to see that Meleagrant knew who Lancelot was, and had no desire to try conclusions with him. He edged backward, saying in a surly voice, You'll be sorry for this some day, Guinevere. But he gave ground, glowering, and let them pass. Lancelot was dressed with his usual fastidious taste, in crimson tunic and cloak. His hair was carefully trimmed and combed, his face clean-shaven. His hand looked smooth and white as Guinevere's own, although she knew that they were hard and steel-strong. He was handsomer than ever, and he had come just in time to save her from an ugly encounter with Meleagrant. She smiled. She couldn't help herself. It was as if something turned over deep inside her. No, I must not look at him this way now. I am to be the mother of Arthur's son. Lancelot said, You do not want to pass through the great hall, lady, in your draggled riding clothes. Has it been raining most of your journey? Let me take you and your servant to the side door, and you can go directly to your chamber and refresh yourself, and then greet my Lord Arthur in the hall when you are freshly dressed and warm and dry. You are shivering. Is the wind cold on you, Guinevere? He long had the privilege of calling her by name, without the formal my queen or lady, but never had it sounded so sweet on his lips. You are, as ever, thoughtful of me, she said, and let him lead her horse. At the door he helped her to dismount, and she was only aware of the touch of his hands. She lowered her eyes and wouldn't look at him. The great hall is filled with Arthur's companions, he said, and all is confusion. The round table has gone but 3 days ago, on 3 carts to Camelot, and Kai with it to set it in its place in the new hall. Now a rider has gone out in haste to summon Kai back, and such men as can ride from the summer country. She looked up at him, frightened. Gawain told us of the Saxon landing. Is this truly the war Arthur feared? It is what we have all known for years must come, Gwen, he said quietly. For this Arthur has been training his legions, and I working with his horse troops. When this is over, perhaps we shall have the peace we have longed for, all my life, and all Uther's. Suddenly she flung her arms around him. You could be killed, she whispered. It was the first time she had had courage to do such a thing. She stood pressed against him, holding her face against his shoulder, and his arms went around her. Even through her fear, she felt the sweetness that he would hold her so. He said, and his voice shook, We all knew that it must come some day soon, my dear. By our good fortune, we have had years to prepare for it, and Arthur to lead us. Do even you know what a great leader of men he is, and how dear we all hold him? He is young, but he is the greatest of the high kings we have had since long before the time of the Romans. And with Arthur to lead us, we will certainly drive the Saxons hence. And for the rest, it's as God wills, Guinevere. He patted her shoulder gently, saying, Poor girl, you are so wearied. Let me take you to your women. But she could feel his hands trembling, and was suddenly shamed that she had thrown herself into his arms as if she were a camp follower. In her own chambers all was confusion. Meleus putting garments into boxes, Elaine supervising the serving women. Elaine came and took Guinevere in her arms, crying out, kinswoman, we have been so worried about you on the roads. We had hoped that you had the message before leaving the convent, and would stay safe in Tintagel.
No, said Guinevere.
Igraine died.
Gawain met with us when we had already been a whole day on the road.
And besides, my place is at my husband's side.
Melias asked,
Lady, did Griflet return with you?
Guinevere nodded.
He escorted me here. You will see him at dinner, I suppose. I heard Gaheris say that all of Arthur's companions had been bidden to dine with the king.
Melias said,
If you can call it dining. It's more like gobbling soldiers' rations. This place is like an armed camp, and it will be worse before it is better. But Elaine and I have done our best to keep all things in order. She was a usually smiling, plump young woman, who now looked worried and tired. I have put all your gowns and such things as you shall need for this summer into boxes, so that you may be ready to ride for Camelot in the morning. The king said we were all to go at once, and it is all but ready for occupancy, with the work that Kai has done. But we never thought we would go there like this in haste and almost under siege.
No, thought Guinevere,
I have been riding these days, and now I will not ride forth again. My place is here, and my son has a right to be born in his father's own castle. I will not again be sent hither and thither like any bit of luggage or saddlery. She said, Be at ease, Melias. Perhaps there is no such haste as all this. Send someone for wash water and fetch me some gown which is not soaked and bedraggled by mud and travel. And who are all these women?
These women, it turned out, were wives of some of the companions and of certain of Arthur's subject kings who would be sent with them to Camelot. It was easier if they all travelled in convoy, and there they would be safe from the Saxons.
It is near to your home,
Elaine said, as if that should settle all Guinevere's unwillingness. You can visit your father's wife and your little brothers and sisters. Or, while Leodegrance is at war, your stepmother will dwell with us at Camelot.
That would be no pleasure to either of us, Guinevere thought, and then was ashamed of herself.
She felt like ending all of this with a few words.
I am pregnant, I cannot travel.
But she shrank from the excited flurry of questions she knew would follow. Arthur should know it first. Chapter 12. When Guinevere came into the great hall, which looked barren and empty without the great round table and all the splendour of banners and tapestries and hangings gone, Arthur was sitting at a trestle table halfway down the hall near the fires, surrounded by half a dozen of his companions, others clustered near. She had been so eager to tell her news, but now she couldn't blurt it out before the whole court. She must wait until tonight, when they were alone in bed. That was the only time she ever had him to herself at all. But when he looked up from his companions and saw her, he rose and came to embrace her.
"Gwen, my dearest," he said. "I had hoped Gawain's message would keep you safe in Tintagel."
"Are you angry that I've come back?"
He shook his head.
"No, of course not. So the roads are still safe, then, and you were lucky," he said.
"But I suppose this must mean that my mother... "She died 2 days ago and was buried within the convent walls," Guinevere said. "And I set out at once to bring you the news. And now you have nothing but reproach for me that I didn't stay safely at Tintagel because of this war."
"Not reproach, my dear wife," he said gently. "Concern for your safety. But Sir Griflet cared well for you, I can see. Come and sit with us here."
He led her to a bench and seated her at his side. The silver and pottery dishes had vanished. She supposed they too had been sent to Camelot, and she wondered what had happened to the fine red dish of Roman make which her stepmother had given her at her wedding. The walls were bare and the place stripped, and they ate their food out of plain wooden bowls, the crude carved stuff of the markets. She said, dipping a piece of bread into the dish, "Already this place looks as if a battle had swept over it."
"It seemed as well to me that everything should be sent ahead to Camelot," he said. "And then we had the rumours of the Saxon landings, and all's confusion. Your father is here, my love. No doubt you will want to greet him."
Leodegrance was seated near, though not in the inner ring of those around Arthur. She came and kissed him, feeling his bony shoulders under her hands. Always her father had been a big man to her, big and imposing, and now, suddenly, he seemed old and wasted.
"I told my Lord Arthur he should not have sent you travelling about the countryside at this time," he said. "Ah, yes. No doubt it was well done of Arthur that he wished to send you to his mother's deathbed. But he had a duty to his wife, too, and Igraine has an unwedded daughter who should have been with her mother. Where is the Duchess of Cornwall that she did not go?"
"I do not know where Morgaine is," said Arthur. "My sister is a woman grown, and her own mistress. She need not seek my leave to be here or there."
"Aye, it is ever so with a king," said Leodegrance querulously. "He is lord of all save his women folk. Eleanor is the same, and I have three daughters, not even old enough to marry, and they think they rule my household. You will see them at Camelot, Guinevere. I've sent them there for safekeeping, and the oldest, Isotta, is old enough. You might wish to make her one of your ladies, your own half-sister. And since I have no sons living, I want you to ask Arthur to marry her to one of his best knights when she's old enough."
Guinevere shook her head in amazement at the thought of Isotta, her half-sister, old enough to come to court. Well, she'd been almost 7 years old when Guinevere was married. Now she must be a great girl of 12 or 13. Elaine had been no older when she was brought to Caerleon. No doubt, if she asked, Arthur would give Isotta to one of his best knights. Gawain, perhaps. Or possibly, since Gawain would be king of Lothian some day, to Gaheris, who was the king's own cousin. She said, "I'm certain that Arthur and I together will find someone for my sister."
"Lancelot is still unwed," suggested Leodegrance. "And so is Duke Marcus of Cornwall. Though no doubt it would be more suitable if Marcus married the Lady Morgaine and they combined their claims. Then would the lady have someone to keep her castle and defend her lands. And though I understand the lady is one of the damsels of the Lady of the Lake, no doubt Duke Marcus could tame her."
Guinevere smiled at the thought of Morgaine being tamely married to someone they thought suitable. And then she grew angry. Why should Morgaine please herself? No other woman was allowed to do her own will. Even Igraine, who was mother to the king, had been married as her elders thought good. Arthur should exert his authority and get Morgaine properly married before she disgraced them all. Conveniently, Guinevere stifled the memory that when Arthur had spoken of marrying Morgaine to his friend Lancelot, she had objected. "Oh, I was selfish. I cannot have him myself, and I grudge him a wife." No, she told herself. She would be happy to see Lancelot married if the girl was suitable and virtuous. Leodegrance asked, "I thought the Duchess of Cornwall was among your ladies." "She was," Guinevere said. "But she left us some years ago to dwell with her kinswoman, and hasn't returned." And it occurred to her once again. Where was Morgaine? Not in Avalon, not in Lothian with Morgawse, not in Tintagel with Igraine. She might be in Less Britain, or on a pilgrimage to Rome, or in the fairy country, or in hell itself, for all Guinevere knew to the contrary. This couldn't go on. Arthur had a right to know where dwelt his nearest kinswoman now that his mother was dead. But surely Morgaine would have come to her mother's deathbed if she could. She went back to her place beside Arthur. Lancelot and the king were drawing with the tips of their daggers on the wooden boards before them while they ate absent-mindedly out of the same dish. Biting her lip. Indeed, she might as well have stayed in Tintagel for all the difference it made to Arthur that she was there or not. She would have withdrawn to a bench with her ladies. But Arthur looked up at her and smiled, holding out his arm to her.
"Nay, my dear one, I meant not to drive you away. I must indeed talk with my captain of horse, but there is room for you here too."
He beckoned to one of the servers.
"Bring another plate of meat for my lady. Lancelot and I have made a wreck of this dish. There is fresh baked bread too somewhere, if any of it is left, though with Kai not here the kitchens are in chaos."
"I think I have eaten enough," Guinevere said, leaning a little against his shoulder, and he patted her absently. She could feel Lancelot warm and solid on the other side, and she felt secure and safe between them. Arthur leaned forward, one hand still stroking her hair, the other holding the dagger where he was sketching.
"Look, can we bring the horses up this way? We can travel fast and leave the wagons with provisions and baggage to come around on the flat country. But men with horses can cut across country and march light and fast. Kai has had men baking hard journey bread for the armies and stockpiling it these 3 years since Celloden Wood. It is likely they will land here."
He pointed to a spot on the rough map he had made.
"Leodegrance, Uriens, come here and look at this."
Her father came, and with him another man, slight and dark and dapper, though his hair was greying and his face lined.
"King Uriens," Arthur said, "I greet you as my father's friend and mine. Have you met my lady Guinevere?"
Uriens bowed. His voice was pleasant and melodious.
"My pleasure to speak with you, madam. When the country is more settled, I will bring my wife, if I may, to present to you at Camelot."
"I shall be pleased," Guinevere said, feeling that her voice was insincere. Never had she learned how to speak these polite platitudes so that they carried any conviction.
"It will not be this summer. We have other work to do," said Uriens.
He bent over Arthur's rough map.
"In Ambrosius's time, we led an army up country this way. We had not so many horses, save with the baggage wagons, but one could bring them up and cut across ground here. You must keep out of swamps as you go to the south of the summer country." "I had hoped not to climb the fells," said Lancelot. Uriens shook his head. "With that great body of horse, it is better.
On those hills horses slip on stone and break their legs," Lancelot argued.
"Better even that, Sir Lancelot, than have men and horses and wagons all be mired. Better fells than swamps," said Uriens. "Look, here lies the old Roman wall."
"I cannot see where so many have scribbled," said Lancelot impatiently. He went to the fireplace and plucked out a long stick, shook out the fire on the end, and began drawing on the floor with the charcoal stick.
"Look, here lies the summer country, and here the lakes and the Roman wall. We have, say, 300 horse, and here 200.
"So many indeed," Uriens demanded incredulously.
"The legions of Caesar had no more."
7 years we've been training them, and training mounted soldiers in their use," said Lancelot.
"Thanks to you, dear cousin," Arthur said.
Lancelot turned and smiled.
"Thanks to you, my king, who had vision to see what we could do with them."
"Some soldiers still know not how to fight on horseback," said Uriens. "As for me, I fought well enough leading men on foot."
"And that is as well," said Arthur good-naturedly. "For we have not horses for every man who wishes to fight mounted, nor saddles and stirrups and harness for all.
though I have had every harness maker in my kingdom working as fast as he might. And hard enough work I've had to levy enough money to pay for all this, and men thinking me a greedy tyrant.
He chuckled, patting Guinevere on the back and saying,
All this time I've had hardly enough gold of my own to buy my queen silks for her embroidery. It has all gone to horseflesh and smiths and saddlers.
Suddenly the gaiety was gone, and he was serious, almost frowning.
And now is the great test of all that we have done, and all that we can do. The Saxons this time are a flood, my friends. If we cannot stop them with less than half their numbers, there will be none fed in this country but ravens and wolves.
That is the advantage of horse troops, said Lancelot gravely.
Armed and mounted men can fight 5, 10, it may be 20 times their number. We shall see, and if we have guessed right, we shall stop the Saxons once and for all time. If we have not, well, we shall die defending our own homes and the lands we love, and our women and little children. Aye, said Arthur softly, that we would. For what else have we worked since we were tall enough to hold a sword, Galahad?
He smiled, his rare, sweet smile. And Guinevere thought, with a stab of pain, Never does he smile at me like that. Yet when he hears what news I bear him, why, then... For a moment, Lancelot answered the smile. Then he sighed.
I had a dispatch from my half-brother Lionel, Ban's eldest son. He said he would set sail in 3 days. No,
he stopped, counting on his fingers.
He is already at sea. The messenger was delayed. He has 40 ships, and he hopes to drive the Saxon ships, or as many as he may, onto the rocks, or south to the Cornish coast, where they cannot land their troops aright. Then, when he lands, he will march his men to where we are gathering. I should send a messenger with a place for rendezvous.
He pointed to the improvised map on the stones. Then there was a little stirring of voices at the door of the room, and a tall, thin, greying man strode in through the scattered benches and trestle tables. Guinevere hadn't seen Lot of Lothian since before the Battle of Culloden Wood.
Why, I see Arthur's hall as I never thought to see it, bare without his round table. What, Arthur, cousin, playing at knuckle-boons on the floor with all your schoolfellows? The round table's already gone to Camelot, kinsman, said Arthur, rising, with all my other furniture and women's gear. You see here an armed camp waiting only for daybreak to send the last of the women to Camelot. Most of the women and all of the children are already gone.
Lot bowed to Guinevere and said in his smooth voice,
Why then, Arthur's hall will be barren indeed. But is it safe for women and children to travel with the land rising for war? The Saxons have not yet come so far inland, said Arthur, and there is no danger if they go at once. I must tell 50 of my men, and a thankless job it is, to stay out of the field and guard Camelot. Queen Morgause is well where she is, in Lothian. I'm glad my sister is with her. Morgaine?
Lot shook his head.
She's not been in Lothian these many years. Well, well, well. I wonder where she may have gone, and with whom. I always thought there was more to that young woman than I ever could see. But why to Camelot, my lord Arthur? It's easily defended, said Arthur. 50 men can hold it till Christ should come again. If I left the women at Carleon here, I would need to hold back 200 men or more from the battle. I know not why my father made Carleon his stronghold. I had hoped before the Saxons came again we would be gone with all our court to Camelot, and then they would have to march across Britain's width to come at us, and we could give them battle on a field of our own choosing. If we led them into the swamps and lakes of the summer country, where the land is never the same 2 years in a row. Why, then, mud and swamps could do some of the work of bow and arrow and axe for us, and the little folk of Avalon finish them off with their elf arrows.
They will come to do that anyway, said Lancelot, rising on his knees from studying the map on the stones. Avalon has already sent 300, and more will come, they say. And the Merlin said, when last I spoke with him, that they had sent riders into your country too, my lord Uriens, so that all the old people who dwell in your hills may come to fight at our side. So we have the legion, horse soldiers fighting on the flat ground, every horseman armoured and armed with spears, good for a dozen or more Saxons. Then we have multitudes of foot soldiers, bowmen and swordsmen, who can fight in the hills and the valleys. And then we have many of the men of the tribes with pikes and axes, and the old people who can fight from ambush and drop men with their elf arrows unseen. I think we could thus meet every Saxon from all of Gaul and the shores of the continent.
And we will have to do just that, said Lot. I have fought the Saxons since the days of Ambrosius, so has Uriens here. And never have we had to face anything like the army coming against us now. Since I was crowned, I have known this day was coming. The Lady of the Lake told me this when she gave me Excalibur. And now she is sending for all the folk of Avalon to rally beneath the banner of the Pendragon. We will all be there, said Lot.
But Guinevere shuddered, and Arthur said solicitously,
My dear one, you've been riding all day and the day before, and you must set forth again at daybreak. May I call your women to take you away to bed?
She shook her head, twisting her hands together in her lap. No, I'm not weary. No. Arthur, it seems no proper thing for the pagans of Avalon, ruled by sorcery, to fight on the side of a Christian king. And when you rally them under that pagan banner. Lancelot asked gently,
My queen, would you have the folk of Avalon sit and watch their homes fall into the hands of the Saxon? Britain is their land too. They will fight even as we do to hold our land against the barbarians. And the Pendragon is their sworn king.
It is that I do not like, said Guinevere, trying to make her voice steady so that she didn't sound like a little girl raising her voice in the men's council.
After all, she told herself,
Morgause is accepted as one of Lot's councillors, and Vivian never stinted to speak of matters of state. I like it not that we and the folk of Avalon should fight on the same side. This battle shall be the stand of civilized men, followers of Christ, descendants of Rome, against those who know not our God. The old people are of the enemy as much as the Saxons, and this will not be a proper Christian land until all those folk are dead or fled into their hills and their demon gods with them. And I like it not, Arthur, that you should raise a pagan banner for your standard. You should fight, like Uriens, under the cross of Christ, so that we may tell friend from foe.
Lancelot looked shocked. Am I also your enemy, Guinevere?
She shook her head. You are a Christian, Lancelot.
My mother is that same wicked Lady of the Lake you condemn for her witchcraft, he said. And I myself was fostered in Avalon, and the old people are my own people. My own father, who is a Christian king, made also the great marriage with the goddess for his land.
He looked hard and angry. Arthur laid his hand on the hilt of Excalibur, in its scabbard of crimson velvet and gold. The sight of his hand laid on the magical symbols of that scabbard, and the serpents twined round his wrist, made Guinevere turn her eyes away. She said, How will God give us the victory if we will not put away from us all the symbols of sorcery and fight beneath his cross?
Why? There's something to what the Queen says,
Uriens said, conciliating.
But I bear my eagles in the name of my fathers and of Rome, Leodegrance said, I offer to you the banner of the cross, my lord Arthur, if you will. You bear it rightly for your queen's sake.
Arthur shook his head. Only the high flush in his cheekbones told Guinevere that he was angry.
I swore to fight beneath the royal banner of the Pendragon. And so shall I do, or die. I am no tyrant. Whoever wishes to do so may bear the cross of Christ on his shield. But the Pendragon banner stands in token that all the folk of Britain, Christian, Druid, old people too, shall fight together. Even as the dragon is over all the beasts, so the Pendragon is over all the people. All, I say. And the eagles of Uriens and the great raven of Lothian shall fight beside the dragon, said Lot, rising. Is Gawain not here, Arthur? I would have a word with my son, and I thought he was ever at your side. I miss him as much as you, uncle, said Arthur. I know not where to turn without Gawain at my back. But I had to send him on a message to Tintagel, for none can ride so swiftly. Oh, you've plenty to guard you, said Lot sourly. I see Lancelot never more than a step or three from your side, ready to fill the empty place.
Lancelot flushed, but he said smoothly,
It is always so, kinsman. All of Arthur's companions strive with one another for the honour of being the closest to the king. And when Gawain is here, even Kai, who is Arthur's foster brother, and I, who am Queen's champion, must take a place further off.
Arthur turned back to Guinevere and said,
Now indeed, my queen, you must go to rest. This council may go on far into the night, and you must be ready to ride at daybreak.
Guinevere clenched her hands. This one time, let me have the courage to speak. She said clearly, No, my lord, I do not ride at daybreak. Not to Camelot, or to anywhere else on the face of this earth. Arthur's cheeks flushed again with that high colour which told her he was angry.
Why, how's this, madam? You cannot delay when there is war in the land. I would willingly give you a day or two of rest before you ride, but we must make haste to get you all to safety before the Saxons come. I tell you, Guinevere, when the morning comes, your horse and gear will be ready. If you cannot ride, you may travel in a litter or be carried in a chair, but ride you shall.
I shall not, she said fiercely, and you cannot force me, not unless you set me on my horse and tie me there.
God forbid I should have to do so, Arthur said. But what is this lady?
He was troubled, yet trying to keep his voice light and humorous.
Why, all those legions of men out there obey my word. Am I to have mutiny at my own hearth-fire, and from my own wife?
Your men may all obey your word, she said desperately. They have not my reason for staying here. I will stay with no more than one waiting woman and a midwife, my lord. But I will ride nowhere, not so far as to the banks of the river, before our son is born. There, I have said it. Here, before all these men. And Arthur, hearing, understood, and instead of looking overjoyed, seemed only dismayed. He shook his head and then said, Guinevere, and stopped.
Lot chuckled and said, Are you breeding, madam? Why, congratulations, but that need not stop you from travelling. Morgause was every day in the saddle, till she was too big for her horse to carry her, while no one would know as yet that you were with child. Our midwives say that fresh air and exercise are healthy for a breeding woman, and when my own favourite mare is in foal, I ride her till 6 weeks before she drops the foal.
I'm not a mare, said Guinevere coldly. And twice I have miscarried.
Would you expose me again to that, Arthur? Yet you cannot stay here. This place cannot be properly defended, said Arthur distractedly, and we may march out with the army at any time. Nor is it fair to ask your women to stay with you and risk being caught by the Saxons. I am certain it will not harm you, dear wife. There were pregnant women with those who left for Camelot last week. And you cannot stay here with all your women gone. It will be an armed soldiers' camp, no more, my Gwen.
Guinevere looked at her ladies.
Will not one of you stay with her queen?
I will stay with you, cousin, if Arthur permits, said Elaine.
And Melias said, I will stay, if my lord doesn't mind.
Though our son is already at Camelot.
No, Melias. You must go to your child, Elaine said. I am her kinswoman, and I can endure anything Guinevere can endure, even to live in an armed camp with the men.
She came and stood beside Guinevere, holding her hand.
But could you not travel in a litter? Camelot is so much safer.
Lancelot got up and came to Guinevere. He bent over her hand and said in a low voice, My lady, I beg you to go with the other women. This countryside may all be in ruin within a matter of days when the Saxons come. In Camelot you are near to your father's country. My own mother dwells in Avalon within a day's journey. She is a notable healer woman and midwife, and I'm sure she would come to you and care for you, or even stay to be with you when the baby's born. If I send to my mother with a message to come to you, will you go?
Guinevere bent her head, fighting not to cry. Once again I must do as I am bid, like any woman, no matter what I want.
Now even Lancelot had joined in to get her to do what she was told. She remembered the journey here from the summer country. Even with Igraine at hand she'd been terrified, and all this day she had ridden across the dreadful moors from Tintagel. Now she was safe within walls, and it seemed to her that she would never again be willing to leave their shelter.
Perhaps when she was stronger,
when her son was safe in her arms,
then perhaps she could dare that journey. But not now. And Lancelot could offer her as a gift the company of that evil sorceress, his mother? How could he think she would let such a sorceress near her son?
Arthur might contaminate himself with vows and links to Avalon, but her son should never be touched by that pagan evil.
It is kind of you, Lancelot, she said stubbornly, but I shall go nowhere until my son is born.
Even if you were taken to Avalon itself, Arthur asked, you and our son would be safer there than anywhere in this world.
She shivered and crossed herself. God and Mary Virgin forbid, she whispered. I would as soon go into the fairy country itself.
Guinevere, listen to me, he began urgently.
Then sighed in defeat, and she knew she had won.
Have it as you will. If the danger of travel seems greater to you than the danger of remaining here, then God forbid I should force you to travel.
Gaheris said wrathfully, Arthur, will you let her do this?
I say to you, you should bundle her onto her horse and send her forth whether she will or not.
My king, will you listen like this to a woman's raving? Arthur shook his head wearily.
Peace, cousin, he said. It's easy to see you are no married man. Guinevere, do as you will. Elaine may remain with you, and one serving woman, and a midwife, and your priest, but no more. Everyone else must ride at daybreak. And now you must go to your chamber, Gwen. I have no more time for this.
And Guinevere, dutifully raising her cheek for his dutiful kiss, had no sense that she had won a victory. The other women set forth at daybreak. Melias begged to stay with the queen, but Griflet wouldn't have it.
Elaine has neither husband nor child,
he said. "Let her stay. Yet if I were King Pellinore, I would not let my daughter remain, queen or no. You shall go, my lady." And Guinevere fancied that the look he gave her was one of scorn. And Arthur made it clear to her that the main part of the castle was now the army camp, and she must keep to her chambers with Elaine and the serving women. Most of her furniture had been sent to Camelot. A bed was brought up from the guest chamber, and she slept in it with Elaine. Arthur spent his nights in the camp with the men, sending to inquire for her once a day, but she rarely saw him. At first, she thought every day that she would see them march out to do battle with the Saxons, or that the battle would sweep over them here. But day followed day, and then week came after week, and she heard no news. Solitary riders and messengers came and went, and Guinevere could see more armies gathering, but immured in her chamber and the tiny garden behind it, she heard only such scattered bits of news as her servant and the midwife could bring, much garbled, and mostly gossip. The time hung heavy over her. She was queasy in the morning, and wished for nothing but to lie in bed, though later she felt well, and would pace the garden restlessly, with nothing to do but make pictures in her mind of the marauding Saxons off the coast, and think of her child. She would have liked to sew on baby clothes, but she had no wool to spin, and the big loom had gone already. However, she had the small loom, and the silks and spun wool and embroidery gear which had gone with her to Tintagel, and she began to plan the weaving of a banner. Once Arthur had promised her that when she gave him a son, she might ask him for whatever gift was in his power to give, and she had it in mind that on that day she would ask him to put aside the pagan banner of the Pendragon and raise Christ's cross. That would make all this land under the High King a Christian land, and Arthur's legion a holy army under the protection of Mary the Virgin. It was most beautiful as she planned it, blue with gold thread, and her priceless crimson-dyed silks for the mantle of the Virgin. She had no other occupation, so she sewed at it from morning to night, and with Elaine to help her, it grew swiftly under her fingers. And into every stitch of this banner shall I weave my prayers that Arthur shall be safe, and this a Christian land from Tintagel to Lothian. One afternoon the Merlin came to visit her, Taliesin the Venerable. She hesitated. Was it right she should have that old pagan and demon worshipper near to her at such a time as this, when she bore Arthur's son, who would one day be the king of this Christian land? But looking at the old man's kindly eyes, she recalled that this was Igraine's father, and would be great-grandfather to her babe. "May the Eternal bless you, Guinevere," he said, spreading out his arms in blessing. She made the sign of the cross, then wondered if he would be offended, but he seemed to take it simply as an exchange of blessings.
"How do you, lady, in this close confinement?" he said, looking around the room. "Why, you might be dungeoned here. You would be better in Camelot, or in Avalon, or on the isle at Ynys Witron. You went to school there with the nuns, did you not? And there at least you would have had fresh air and exercise. This room is like to a byre."
"I have air enough in the garden," said Guinevere, resolving that the bedding should be aired that very day, and that the serving woman should air and sweep the room which was littered with their possessions. It was too small for four women.
"Then make certain, my child, that you walk every day in the fresh air, even if it is raining. Air is medicine for all ills," he said. "I can well believe that you are dull here." "No, child, I didn't come to reproach you," he added gently. "Arthur told me your happy news, and I rejoice for you, as do we all. And I especially. Not many men live so long as to look on the face of their great-grandchildren."
His creased old face seemed to glow with benevolence.
"If there is anything I can do for you, you must command me, lady. Are they sending you suitable fresh food, or only soldiers' rations?
Guinevere assured him that she had everything she could wish for. Every day a basket of the finest provisions to be had reached her, though she didn't tell him she had little wish for food. She told him of Igraine's death, and that she lay buried in Tintagel, and that Igraine's last act had been to tell her of her child. Of the sight, she said little, but she did ask, looking at the old man with troubled eyes, "Sir, do you know where dwells Morgaine, that she didn't come even to her mother's deathbed?" He shook his head slowly.
"I'm sorry, I know not."
"But this is scandalous, that Morgaine should not let her kin know whither she has gone."
"It may be that some of the priestesses of Avalon do. She has gone on some magical quest, or secluded herself to seek vision,"
Taliesin ventured, and he too looked troubled.
"In that case I would not have been told, but I think, if she were in Avalon, where my own daughter dwells with the priestesses, I would have known." "I know not,"
he sighed.
"Morgaine is a woman grown, and she need not seek leave of any man to come and go."
It would serve Morgaine right, thought Guinevere, if she came to grief for her own stubbornness and the godless way in which she did her own will. She clenched her fists and didn't answer the druid, looking down so that he wouldn't see her anger. He thought well of her. She would not have him think otherwise of her. Nor did he notice, for Elaine was showing him the banner. "See, this is how we spend our prison days, good father."
"It grows swiftly," said the Merlin, smiling. "I see well that there is no time. What is it your priests say? The devil finds work for the idle. You have left no place for the devil to do his work here. You are as busy as a hive of bees, you two. Already I can see the beautiful design."
"And as I wove it, I prayed," said Guinevere defiantly.
"With every stitch I wove a prayer that Arthur and the cross of Christ may triumph over the Saxons and their pagan gods."
"Will you not rebuke me then, Lord Merlin, that I do this when you bid Arthur fight under their pagan banner?" The Merlin said mildly,
"Prayer is never wasted, Guinevere. Do you think we know nothing of prayer? When Arthur was given his great sword Excalibur, it was sheathed in a scabbard into which a priestess worked prayers and spells for safety and protection, and she fasted and prayed for 5 days all the time she worked upon it. And no doubt you have taken note that even though he is wounded, he sheds but little blood."
"I would have him protected with Christ, not sorcery," said Guinevere hotly, and the old man smiled and said,
"God is one. And there is but one God. All else is but the way the ignorant seek to put gods into a form they can understand. Like the image of your virgin there, lady. Nothing befalls on this world without the blessing of the one who will give us victory or defeat as God shall ordain. Dragon and virgin alike are the signs of man's appeal to what is higher than we."
"But would you not be angry if the Pendragon banner was torn down and the standard of the Virgin raised over our legion?" asked Guinevere scornfully. He stood close to her, reaching out a wrinkled hand to caress the brilliant silks.
"Such a thing of beauty as this is," he said gently, "and made with such love. How could I possibly condemn it? But there are those who love their Pendragon standard as you love the cross of Christ. Would you deny them their holy things, madam? Those of Avalon, druid, priest and priestess, would know that the banner is but a symbol, and the symbol is nothing, while the reality is all. But the little folk? No, they would not understand, and they must have their dragon as a symbol of the king's protection."
Guinevere thought of the little people of Avalon and the far hills of Wales, who who had come bearing bronze axes and even little arrows of flint, their bodies smeared crudely with paint. She shuddered in horror that a folk so wild and savage should fight at the side of a Christian king. The Merlin saw her shivering and mistook its cause.
"It is dank and chill here," he said. "You must go out more into the sunlight."
But then understanding touched him, and he put his arm around the woman at his side and said gently,
"Dear child, you must remember this country is for all men, whatever their gods, and we fight against the Saxons not because they will not worship our gods, but because they wish to burn and ravage our lands and take all that we have for themselves. We fight to defend the peace of these lands, lady, Christian and pagan alike. That is why so many have flocked to Arthur's side. Would you have him a tyrant who put the souls of men in slavery to his own god, as not even the Caesars dared to do?"
But she only shivered, and Taliesin said he must go, but that she should send him word if she had need of anything. Elaine asked, "Is Kevin the bard in the castle, Lord Merlin?"
"Yes, I think so. I should have thought of that. I shall send him to come and play his harp for you ladies while you are cloistered here."
"We would willingly have him," said Elaine. "But what I was asking is, might we borrow his harp? Or yours, Lord Druid?"
He hesitated and said, "Kevin would not lend his harp. My lady is a jealous mistress."
He smiled.
"And as for mine, it is consecrated to the gods, and I may let no other touch it. But the Lady Morgaine didn't take her harp with her when she went away. It is in her rooms. Shall I have it sent here, Lady Elaine? Can you play it?"
"Not well," said Elaine, "but I know enough of harp music to do it no harm, and it would give our hands something to do when we are weary of stitching."
"Yours," said Guinevere. "I have always thought it unseemly for a woman to play on the harp."
"So be it unseemly, then," said Elaine. "But I think I shall go mad shut away here if I have nothing to do. And there is none to see me, even if I dance naked like Salome before Herod."
Guinevere giggled, then looked scandalized. What would the Merlin think?
But the old man laughed heartily.
"I will send you Morgaine's harp, lady, and you may indulge in your unseemly pastime. Though, indeed, I see nothing unseemly in the making of music."
That night, Guinevere dreamed that Arthur stood beside her, but that the serpents on his wrists came alive and crawled to her banner, leaving it all cold with their slime and fouled. She woke, gasping and retching, and that day she had no strength to leave her bed. Arthur came that afternoon to see her and stood distraught beside her.
"I cannot see that this confinement does you any good, lady," he said. "I wish you were safe in Camelot. I have had word from the kings of Less Britain. They have driven 30 Saxon ships onto the rocks, and we will be marching out in 10 days more."
He bit his lip.
"I would this were over, and we were all safe at Camelot. Pray to God, Gwen, that we come safe there."
He sat on the bed beside her, and she took his hand. But one of her fingers touched the serpents on his wrist, and she drew it back with a gasp of dismay.
"What is it, Gwen?" he whispered, drawing her into his arms. "My poor girl, being shut up here has made you ill. I was afraid of this."
She fought to control her tears. I dreamed. "Oh, Arthur," she begged, sitting bolt upright in bed and throwing back the covers. "I cannot bear to think of it, that you would let that foul dragon cover all, as it was in my dream. Look what I've made for you." Barefoot, she drew him with both hands to the loom. "See, it is near finished. In 3 days I could have it ready." He put his arm round her and held her close.
"I wish it did not mean so much to you, Guinevere. I'm sorry.
I will carry it to battle beside the Pendragon banner, if you will. But I cannot abandon the vow I have sworn.
God will punish you if you keep a vow you have made to pagan folk and not to him, she cried. He will punish us both.
He put away her clinging hands.
My poor girl, you are sick and wretched, and no wonder in this place.
And now, alas, it is too late to send you away, even if you would go.
There may be Saxon bands between here and Camelot. Try to be calm, my love, he said,
and went toward the door. She ran after him, holding to his arm.
You are not so angry.
Angry? When you are ill and overwrought?
He kissed her brow.
But we will not speak of this again, Guinevere. And now I must go. I'm expecting a messenger who may come at any instant.
I will send Kevin to play for you. His music will cheer you. He kissed her again and went away, and Guinevere went back to the banner and began to work at it in a frenzy. Kevin came late the next day, dragging his misshapen body on a stick. His harp was hitched over one shoulder, giving him more than ever the look of some monstrous hunchback in silhouette against the door. It seemed to Guinevere that his nose wrinkled in distaste, and suddenly she could see the room through his eyes, cluttered with the daily things of four women, the air not over fresh. He raised his hand in the druid blessing, and Guinevere flinched. She could accept this from the venerable Taliesin, but from Kevin it filled her with dread, as if he would bewitch her and her babe with pagan sorcery. Secretly she signed herself with the cross, and wondered if he saw. Elaine went to him and said courteously, "Let me help you with the harp, Master Harper."
He shrugged as if to ward her away, though his smooth singer's voice was perfectly civil. "I thank you, but no one may touch my lady. If I carry her with my own hands when I can hardly drag myself along on a stick, do you not think there is a reason, madam?"
Elaine bent her head like a scolded child and said, "I meant no harm, sir."
"Of course not. How could you know?" he said,
and twisted painfully, or so it seemed to Guinevere, to unsling his harp and set it on the floor. "Are you comfortable, Master Harper? Will you have a cup of wine to soothe your throat before you sing?" Guinevere asked, and he accepted politely enough. Then, noting the banner of the cross on the loom, he said to Elaine,
"You are King Pellinore's daughter, are you not, madam? Are you weaving a banner for your father to carry into battle?"
Guinevere said quickly, "Elaine's hands worked as skilfully as mine, but the banner is for Arthur." His rich voice was as detached as if he were admiring a child's first attempt to spin.
"It is beautiful, and will make a fair wall-hanging for Camelot when you go there, madam. But I'm sure Arthur will carry the Pendragon banner, as did his father before him. But ladies love not to speak of battles. Shall I play for you?"
He set his hands to the strings and began to play.
Guinevere listened, spellbound,
and her serving woman crept to the door to listen too, aware of sharing a royal gift. He played for a long time in the gathering dusk, and as she listened, Guinevere was borne away into a world where pagan or Christian made no difference, war or peace, but only the human spirit flaming against the great darkness like an ever-burning torch. When the harp notes finally stilled, Guinevere couldn't speak, and she saw that Elaine was weeping softly in the silence. After a time she said, "Words cannot say what you have given us, Master Harper. I can say only that I will remember it always." Kevin's crooked smile seemed for a moment to mock her emotion and his own as he said,
"Madam, in music, he who gives receives as much as he who hears."
He turned to Elaine and added,
"I see you have the Lady Morgaine's harp. You, then, know the truth of what I say."
She nodded, but said,
I am only the worst of beginners at music. I love to play, but no one could find pleasure in hearing me. I am grateful to my companions for their forbearance while I struggle with the notes.
That is not true. You know we enjoy hearing you.